Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show and download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org. That's ISIC1.org. Use their friendly medical library that translates medical journals for public understanding. Listen to their free speaker series and follow the science on marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a preventative conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. What is prevention? Well, there are three types of prevention approaches to health conditions: primary, secondary, and tertiary. And all three can be applied to physical health as well as to addiction. Primary prevention seeks to prevent a disease entirely. It provides an intervention before the disease occurs. Think about brushing your teeth to prevent dental decay, or wearing a seatbelt to prevent injury from a car crash, or how about diet and exercise to prevent high blood pressure and diabetes? Wouldn't it be nice if we had an intervention to prevent drug addiction in the first place? Well, we have it. It's possible. Secondary prevention offers early detection and treatment. Think of an annual dental exam to find a cavity and fix it before you need a root canal, a crown, or an extraction. Or checking your blood pressure, hemoglobin A1C, or cancer screening to detect and intervene in early disease. We do that for screening of drug and alcohol use, and we offer early intervention. Tertiary prevention is extended to slow down a disease or stop its progression. It doesn't fix or cure disease. That means insulin treatment for diabetes. It controls the disease but doesn't cure it. It's naloxone for overdoses or buprenorphine for opiate use disorder. All forms of prevention are important and vital depending on where people are in their disease. But my favorite, because it has the greatest population effect, is primary prevention. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hey, hi, I'm a medical student on my clerkship rotation right now in the ED, and I'm seeing a lot of overdoses on fentanyl and getting a lot of education and teachings about how we treat it and see what we do really well on the back end. But my question is more along the lines of what kind of education and teachings and good pearls can we get about what's being done to prevent addiction and overdoses in the first place? Thank you.
Thank you, RG, for your question. And I could tell right now that you are going to be an incredible emergency physician. You're asking the right kind of questions and you have an amazing attitude, the one it takes to be a good ER doctor. As an emergency physician, you will be seeing firsthand all of society's problems, and you will know how to treat them from the emergency department perspective. You'll be doing that every shift. But the big question and the challenge that you so eloquently asked is, how do we prevent these problems, these diseases, from happening in the first place? I'm going to pose your question to an expert who dedicated his career and even his retirement to prevention, Peter Komendowski. Peter is one of Iowa's leading advocates for healthy, drug-free communities. He serves as president of the Partnership for a Healthy Iowa and co-director of the Iowa Digital Literacy and Wellness Project. He's a TEDx speaker and hosts a TV show, Surviving Bad, now in its 10th year on air. To learn more about Peter Komendowski, check out the High Truth show notes. Peter Komendowski, welcome to High Truths.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited. I have another TV host doing that. We're doing Quid Pro Quo. You're on my show. I'm going to be on your show. So this is very exciting. But tell our audience about yourself, your background, and how you came into producing Surviving Bad.
Well, it's a fascinating exercise because it correlates with a long-term sort of prevention and community building effort in Iowa. I had a history. I ran an advertising agency in Chicago, and quite frankly, I sold it when technology took over the marketplace. You know, our artists used to paint graphics, develop type. Our jingle writers had pianos in their offices. You know, there were no computers at the time, and there was a huge, robust industry in advertising and media. And then when it started becoming automated, it was a good time for me to sort of quasi-retire. Well, jumping ahead, years later, I ended up in Iowa as a consultant for a firm, which ironically wanted help dealing with trying to humanize the advertising industry because they had grown up on the cusp of all this technology, and they wanted to sort of replicate some of that energy from years past when it was all about people and all about those connections. But while I was doing that, I did an ad campaign for the state of Iowa on drug endangered children, working for an ad agency as a consultant. And I got involved with the Partnership for a Drug-Free Iowa and something called the Face It Together Coalition as sort of a media expert, and they invited me to sit on their board. Now, that was founded by Senator Grassley, leaders in business, in faith, in the community. I was amazed. I had come from Illinois and from Chicago, and here I am in Iowa, and we've got the governor, we've got senators, we've got the top CEOs in the state, the bishops from the religions, the general managers and owners of TV stations and radio networks all getting together saying, how can we make a better Iowa, have healthier communities? So I was really, really excited about being on that show, and I sort of became a subject matter expert sitting on that board. I was a subject matter expert as a user when I was a college kid and a young person. So, I mean, it went around full circle. And of course, that didn't continue as a lifelong problem, but it's an issue, even that kind of use. And so as the timing evolved, there was a request by a local TV station that wanted to do a TV show. They thought, hey, we're doing great things. We want to be in our Iowa markets with these messages on a weekly or monthly basis. And so they started the show, and they were doing a search for a moderator. And we'd be sitting there, I'd be sitting there, we'd listen to people. And in the end, they said, well, why don't you try this? Well, now, if you can imagine a fear of public speaking, which I still have, it's just, I just bury it way down deep inside of me.
I relate to that.
They turned the lights on. They put me in the studio. They put me in front of a fake guest, and I sweated through a suit jacket, a shirt. Like, I don't think I could do this. I can't do this with some kind of medication because I'm so nervous. But we tried it. We worked it. And we said, let's try it. I'll try it for a few episodes and see how it goes. And all of a sudden,
you got it done without medications, right?
Without medication. Absolutely
that's right.
Not.
That's
a
how
lot
you
of
do
deep
it.
Breathing, you know, meditation, yoga, you know, relaxation exercises. But really, it's like anything else. It's like learning to swim. You just realize that it's a different perspective. And actually, it was fun for me because up until then, it was very easy for me to be on the news and be interviewed by somebody. But getting on the other side of it was really, really challenging. And it worked out really well, and it worked out real well for Mediacom in Iowa. And now we're over 250 shows in and 10 years, and we're now weekly. We're doing a lot on Zoom now. We can always go back to live stuff, but we're still waiting for all this sort of the influence of what's happening in public health to settle down.
You get more guests on Zoom because more people are available.
We've had people from Singapore, from England, all over the country. It's been amazing. Australia, it's just nice to bring people together and ideas that we can share. The whole idea was that we were going to bring people in that would share almost intimate aspects, not just of their lives, if they happen to be somebody that was telling their life story, but of their research and of the things they were passionate about and why they did things. And of course, we stayed focused a lot on youth high-risk behavior, which of course, the core was alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. Now it includes social media and other issues with body image and suicide ideation and things like that. So we've expanded our reach to other high-risk behaviors, but this is sort of how the breadcrumbs of the journey followed. And I think the TV show was instrumental in that because it was hard to ignore all the different things that happened at the same time, the comorbidity of mental health issues and substance use disorder issues and family dynamics and generational problems. I started realizing that the vision that our organization had that was very good in terms of a traditional prevention model wasn't really accommodating where the world was going with media. That it was a dramatic shift. There were many, many more influencers in people's lives. And there was a, you know, we talk about stigma, and in the prevention and treatment industry, we think of stigma as an outwardly force. That's what the general public has. But oftentimes we find people in treatment and recovery very stigmatized themselves. You know, they have their own sort of biases, the adaptation biases they have to how they do things and what they do. And the reality out there, you know, I always talk about the fact that the map is not the territory. I can put all the signs on a trail and I can give you a printed map to go anywhere in the world, but to get out there and walk those woods and deal with those hazards and those risks and exercise all those activities you need to be essentially manage the risks effectively, it almost takes a guide. It takes some kind of guidance. And that's what's changing in this high-paced world where images and messages and misinformation as well as information traffic so quickly, that sort of slow, steady heartbeat of things like prevention need to up their game to be able to compete on that level.
Yes. And 10 years in, there's always new material and still interesting and still impactful and still very relevant. So, Surviving Bad, how did it come up with that name?
Well, we had our first year.
Sounds like Breaking Bad.
Yeah, well, it came, you know, the first year we were drugs and children, secrets for parents or something like that. I even forgot our name for the first year, but it's on our website. Drugs and children, secrets for parents. It was very, very explicitly targeted towards parents, but getting the vision and voices of what children were experiencing or issues that were dealing with children.
Interesting. So, yeah, I love the name.
Well, what happened, we sat around one day and said, how about we rename it? You know, we had a new intern and we had a new intro and we're getting better graphics. And I was just joking around. And I said, you know, how about Surviving Bad? And what was the TV show? What's it called?
Breaking Bad.
Yeah. And that's what I was playing off of. And everybody said, oh, that's probably not available. It doesn't work. Breaking Bad was a hit at that time. And I Googled it. We got the website. We got the URL. We just named it Surviving Bad, and it sort of caught on. It's been good.
I like it because, and it also is flexible. All sorts of bad things, right? Yeah. Whether it's a drug or other things, like you mentioned.
And it could be from any perspective, from a doctor's perspective on what needs to be done, or from a person's perspective in terms of the journey they've been on.
Right. I love it. So I have a question for you from RG. RG is a senior medical student now, getting experience in the hospital. He's seeing the overdoses, issues with addiction, mental health crisis. And he has a very smart question, very relevant and perfect for you, is all this preventable? What are we doing to prevent? You know, we're seeing that in the emergency department, but, you know, society is seeing it as large. So are the issues of addiction, even the mental health crisis, is that preventable? And what are we doing? What should we be doing? So let's have a discussion on prevention, your expertise.
That's a really good point. And I think inherent in that question is the fact that we have to accept we're failing in prevention. Because whatever we're doing, all of a sudden we have an opioid epidemic, or we have fentanyl. Now marijuana is reaching epidemic proportions. It's like a whack-a-mole game. Dale Woolery from the Office of Drug Control Policy in Iowa here always talks about that. He goes, we keep charging after these new and emergent trends, but we're not getting ahead of the game. Part of it is because we have a world focused on research and evidence-based data, which is 15 to 17 years late getting to the game, and it's not keeping up with emerging technologies, emerging drugs very well. It's like, it's a car mechanic that does not have a computer to help them diagnose your car is a dinosaur, because they can't work on modern cars. And it's very likely that if we look at the idea of, is it preventable, though, there's two elements to that. One, is there enough knowledge and awareness for at the right stage in people's lives so they can manage risks effectively or safely, or enough support systems for them to do that? And that's a really key question. The other side is, are we building enough compassion for a sense of resiliency to exist? And that resiliency being competent enough to reach out for help when people need it. And that goes back to those core support systems that give people knowledge and education. You know, we grew up in the early parts of American culture. We had very strong families, very strong communities, very strong churches, very strong schools. Everybody was very interconnected. There were very few ideas and ideals that could penetrate through all those layers to effectively impair a child's ability to manage risk. Now, there were things that happened. People drank, people smoked. But as we learned and evolved the knowledge of those risks and science of those risks, we've done better things to make children more aware and reduced the amount of kids that are doing these things. But then if every time we get a new and emergent drug where we have to start from scratch to do that, we never win. So that's the key there is how do we look at what the base needs are of a human being for resiliency and knowledge, understanding risks, so that they carry that into a life, into a journey where they can manage risks better so that we can get ahead of all the kinds of risks that affect human beings. And we're learning that there in this age, and I was shocked when I saw a global survey of teens, young teens, that said the number one concern they had in their lives that caused anxiety was climate change. I mean, when me, it was like getting a job. I mean, there's a million things, but climate change. So now what we're realizing is that kids have a tremendous capacity for compassion, but maybe their view is not quite. Maybe they're looking at climate change sort of as a metaphor for their own lives. And we haven't really taught them to say the real climate in our life.
That's an existential threat that they don't see. So their anxiety, or at least what they're expressing as their anxiety, probably not quite true, is what they're seeing on social media.
Exactly correct. Yeah. So can we get ahead of the game? Well, when we sort of bring those things together so that kids feel there's, we reduce the stigma so they feel it's okay to talk about risks with trusted partners. And we have to build a network of trusted partners. So let's face it, the number one intrusion and trust in people's lives today are computers. Wonderful tools. They're brilliant tools. Technology is brilliant. But the fact is that if you take, you know, if I give a hammer, and a hammer has built every home in America, you know, I mean, at some point in time, a hammer's built most of this country. It's a wonderful tool. But if I hit you in the head with it, its sense of benevolence is gone. Now, would I give a hammer to a 4 or 5 year old and let them walk around the house with it and experiment with it to determine what its uses are and how, no, they destroy your house banging on stuff. And yet we live in a world where experiential knowledge is somehow accepted, where people talk about things like drinking are a part of growing up. You know, all kids go through this phase. And no, that's not true. All kids don't. The majority, right. of people do not use these things.
That's right. That's right. So prevention, I like to, you know, my husband and son are dentists. So prevention is possible, right? For dental decay. It's also preventable for high blood pressure, diabetes, and other health problems, right? And if you teach primary prevention, like brush your teeth, we won't eliminate all dental disease, but we will definitely do primary prevention. And I think what you're saying is that it is possible to do primary prevention with drugs, but it's not just don't use drugs. It's teaching these life skills and the emotional resiliency that you're talking about. And that would prevent drug use and other harms down the road.
Yeah, I think if we look back, like brushing teeth, it is the dentists do a great job, but who makes the child brush their teeth before bedtime? The parent.
Yeah.
Now, are you brushing a child's brain from the negative influences, the tartar buildup, the fear, the body image issues that they're getting from a computer before they go to bed? No, we're not. We're not using that same process. So I'm not trying to oversimplify managing your oral health, but we're not managing mental health very well. And right. So if we are going to be successful at going into the future to change outcomes, we're going to have to work very strongly in the present to create habits and behavioral sort of strengths in children that can prepare them for these.
Great. So let's talk more about that. So we agree prevention is possible. We could have less addiction in this country in the first place. We're failing at it, hence all the ER visits. But what should we be doing differently? And you said times have changed. You know, there used to be computers and technology revolution really changed things of how way our family and friends circle is. And now we've got, the internet. How should we do things differently? Where have we failed and where should we be going?
Well, I think what we've done is sort of institutionalized prevention under this moniker of being evidence-based. And evidence-based, there's a great amount of work being done, and you need to do it. I mean, I talk about substance use problems and disorder as like a forest fire. If the fire is burning, you have to put water on the fire to put it out. So prevention has to happen at the same time, simultaneously. It's not one or the other, like the opioid epidemic. You know, we had a great response to the opioid epidemic. Unfortunately, we're left with a ton of people that because their opioid support system went away, they're using heroin or fentanyl or other products because they became addicts. So we had no real methodology. We had no resilience built into our systems, institutionalized systems, to manage that transition effectively. And we should have almost said, okay, we know we're going to have all these addicts. If we stop this putting out the opioids, we should now have everybody getting prescribed opioids, go through a screening and treatment program, and slowly wean them from this. At the same time, we're then reducing opioid prescriptions to just dramatically shut it down like we did. Sounded good. It's good media bites. It's great for funding all kinds of grants. But the fact of the matter is it left millions of people out there as addicts with no source for their drugs, forcing them to go to the black market. So what do we have to do differently to get into the present? Well, part of it is to take a look at, forget evidence-based strategies, use them as a complement to everything we're doing. But they're no more valuable than if we talk about traveling through time. There's a time travel paradox. You can't go back in time, because if you do, and you should somehow keep your parents from meeting, you wouldn't be born. So if you weren't born, you couldn't have gone back in time. So if there is going to be time travel, according to most physicists, it's going to be going into the future. Well, in a sense, we all have the power to travel into the future by our actions today, because everything we do today influences the future. So if we're going to cure, if we're going to deal with improving prevention and cure addiction and reduce the problems in our future and make prevention effective, we have to admit that we can make changes today that are going to influence outcomes in the future. And we can have good science to start us on the path, but what are we going to do? Well, one of the things you have to do is to get emotional engagement of your participants. People to buy into prevention programs have to be emotionally willing to accept the fact that, number one, there is a problem. The problem might be their problem or somebody else's. They have to care about the problem. And then I'm going to take a little sidebar here. We talk so much about problems and no, 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 which is what happens with evidence-based programs, is they're all about no, 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 what's wrong, what we shouldn't do. And nobody likes growing up in a world of no's. It's the same way when we talk about this problem and without realizing the fact that 90% of the kids that we talk to are never going to be users or abusers of substances. They're primarily good kids. But what they aren't being told is that the burden of those people that their peers that do make those choices, which we would call bad choices, is going to be overwhelming to their healthcare system, to their social services system, to their employment, to productivity, to the long-term health of their communities. So they have as much a vested interest in addiction as the people that are using. And if we could employ the power of those peers knowing that so that they become humanely sensitive and compassionately sensitive, which is inherently builds resilience, they would be able to perform more valuable interventions amongst their own peers in 5th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, planting seeds of health and growth and sort of community that have the power to change the future. It looks like DARE. The prevention industry, which is all evidence-based, got really mad at DARE. But DARE got people so emotionally connected to the problem. Kids that never perceived it before. And so that scared people, because it is scary. But when people teach me to go backpacking, they teach me to be wary of things. They teach me to watch out for poisonous snakes, precipitous sort of positions where you have to employ some methods of safety. There's nothing wrong with a little bit of scared wisdom. You should be scared of venomous snakes before one bites you. You know. So what happens is they went out there and I got everybody so pumped up and emotionally engaged, but what they didn't have was the continuum of education and mental health training to build off of that. They trusted that the event alone would have created the inertia through dialogue and through teachers and everything else to accomplish the job. Well, in fact, they didn't recognize the fact that stigma was so powerful and so strong that it did as much to scare people as it did to help them. And then, of course, if it scares people, we think, oh, taboo.
So the word on the street is that scare tactics don't work, which is why the DARE program didn't work. But I wonder if that's really true. People just say that. But I think if you really talk to people, they'll say for some people, scare tactics work. A lot of people say, you know, I saw those black lungs in school and I said, I don't want to smoke, right? That, you know, and so sometimes that is helpful, not for everybody.
I could answer that because I was in the ad business. Scare tactics absolutely do work, but here's the gig. A scare tactic requires a responsible support system to go along with it. You know, if I scare you and give you no alternative for help or show you why it's important to scare you, you're not going to like me. You're going to, you know, you think, you know, you basically, it scares everybody because you have to improve your capacity for nurturing good things in the context of showing people bad things.
So I'm showing you these black lungs and I'm telling you don't smoke. Is that, I scared you and I said a no, but yet that was effective. And those are the two things they say not to do.
Well, it was effective because we had programs in school, because we had a lot of public education in the media, because we had the head of health in America, the Surgeon General would come out and give things. But take a look at it. I think it was 1972 when the Surgeon General put out the most stringent messages about smoking. And it was 30 years later before we actually saw some results.
Right.
When bad things happen, because we're evidence-based, it takes many years, if not decades, before we can actually start seeing preventable changes. So I will assure you that in 30 years, we'll be doing a lot better job at prevention, but in 30 years, we would have lost a lot of human beings.
So use your ad expertise, media expertise, for an ad on fentanyl. How do you warn on fentanyl and drug use and without scare tactics? I don't think it's scary. It's just real. People really do die. I mean, it's scary, but it's true. And without saying no, which really you shouldn't be using fentanyl.
Well, if I told you, if you got on an airplane, you had a 1%, let's say a 10% chance of dying, would you fly?
10%'s high. No.
1%. 1% chance of dying. You wouldn't fly. It takes, you know, the risks that we take are infinitesimal. Hit by lightning, winning a lottery, you know, even auto accidents, you know, we see upticks, but statistically, they're not that prevalent thing. They just happen to be a high percentage of where we have a lot of fatalities. I think that knowledge is power, but also a sensitivity to questions. You know, if you tell a child no, and they go, why, you better have an answer. But if parents rely on no, no, no to children, what they do is they try and figure out ways around the no. It's simple. You go to one parent, you know, mom, can I go stay overnight at so-and-so's place? Well, yeah, if dad says he can. And you go to dad, can I stay overnight at so-and-so's place? Yeah, mom said I could if you said it was okay. And then all of a sudden they made two parents complicit. I mean, you know, children know how to work this stuff. They also know how to tune out no.
Yeah. I think as a parent, I made sure not to do that. I never said because I said so. I usually had a reason.
And you had a reason. And see, now what happened? If you give them reasons and you make them a partner in the process of learning, not you the adult or you the dominant or you point a finger and say, don't do this, don't do this. If you say, listen, it's really important you don't do this. Let me tell you why. And that evokes their sense of exploration, their sense of curiosity, which is what pulls a lot of kids towards their initial high-risk behavior.
And we do that with so many things, right? We do that. I have, you know, I'm a grandma now. And you say, you know, don't touch the hot fire. Don't cross the street when the light is red. Because what you're saying, it's okay to say no, but it needs to have an explanation that kids understand.
Oh, my son taught me, my youngest son, Jordan, now has grandkids, his children. I remember one day when I was working on a first RGB computer when he was a kid, and I was trying to learn some programs for work because nobody had computers yet. And he came into the den and I was eating a very hot salsa with chips. And he said he wanted some. And I said, no, it's hot. I want some. It's hot. And he touched the container. And he goes, not hot. And I thought, oh, my God, he caught me. So I said, okay, try it. He tried it. He goes, hot. And all of a sudden, so there's, you know, we often perceive that no as the hot that we know. But is it Is it the hot that they perceive? And so he taught me how to teach him by going one step further, rather than simply blindly assuming I was correct. He exhibited some interest and care, which all kids have. It's whether we allow them to express it or not. So if we're going to be successful in prevention, we need to be willing to put our lives out there, say what the problems are, and answer their questions and let them be engaged. I did a classroom once, and I'm not going to say where or how, but I went into schools, and of course you have to be very supervised. And I went with state officials, and I went with the principal and the superintendent to fifth grade classes. I would ask them about kids they knew that might be using alcohol or tobacco or marijuana or other things. And everybody's watching and nobody raises their hands. I said, let's do a favor here. I'm going to have all the adults look to the wall. Okay, kid, nobody's watching. Because I noticed the kids were nervous when I asked the questions. And so we had all the adults in the room are going to turn around and look at the wall. Now, they failed to realize that I was an adult, I guess. And I said, now, how many of you know somebody in your age group, in your grade, that's using alcohol? And you would be shocked how many of the hands went up. And how many of you know they're using tobacco? How many of you know places where you can go to find any of these things? The number of hands that went up, they were just making sure nobody was looking. And so we finished that, and I said, hey, you guys are great. I'm glad to see that everything's so healthy. I did not let on to anybody till later, which was some of the official needed, but not the principal. We walked out of there, and the principal, see, our kids don't have any of these problems. She presumed nobody raised their hand when actually they turned their back. A lot of them did. I said, yeah, you're right. You know, you have a great class.
And it's absolutely true. Addiction starts in middle school and now even younger, grade school. So that is exactly where we want to be if we want to teach that resiliency, teaching especially this generation of kids how to deal with life stresses, because life is hard without resulting to drugs or other risky behaviors like you mentioned.
Well, and I think a lot of people also don't realize that, you know, do the drugs come first, or does the anxiety come first, or the body image problems, or the suicide ideation, or being bullied come first? You know, I mean, sometimes it's that drugs come because a kid gets a surgery in high school as an athlete and they gave him opioids. You know, I mean, but the whole thing is that this landscape is so diverse.
Well, I think I could answer that chicken or the egg question. Okay. The chicken came before the egg, but I think that anxiety or body image or pain or whatever came first, because the drug actually temporarily fixes that problem. And that's where the addiction sticks. The drugs are addicting because on a temporary basis, they actually do work to make you feel better. They help that pain. It's like, oh, well, you know, when I take this, I'm not anxious. So I would say that, you know, that feeling came first. And the drugs actually work for that. The problem is it's temporary and it gets you into worse problems down the road.
Now, what happens to the high school kids that went to a party? Normal kids, maybe no mental health problems. And somebody offers them something and other kids are doing it and they do it and it happens to be something that they OD on. We've seen this happen. Now, where's the chicken and the egg in that picture? That might be the fact that the children weren't taught that the risks were there.
Right.
They
well,
probably
the whole thing, the
it.
Risks yeah. weren't taught, but there was a social pressure. So that something was missing. They needed to act cool, otherwise they didn't have that life skill to say, "Nah, I don't need that." Yep. So it's actually the feeling themselves that came first. So, but you're right, and like you mentioned in your days, you know, you said you weren't that perfect child, but you survived it because there wasn't fentanyl. You know, these days, that same kid makes a mistake, and that's it. It's unforgiving, you know, which really has highlighted this crisis.
Yeah, and we don't know the threshold to different drugs. I mean, a lot of us that were younger might have smoked marijuana that was very weak. But if we had touched the stuff that was higher potency, it could have been a completely different trigger in our lives. And that's the thing is the amount of predatory activity that's affecting children. And again, I hate to do this, but a lot of it comes back to social media. You know, the media itself has broken down the connections to family, faith, and education to the extent that they're being nurtured and raised by strangers, by a conglomeration of
What's the answer to that? And it can't be get rid of social media, because it's here. We're going to have to live with it. It's not all bad. Some of it's good. But what's the answer? How can we use that for a positive effect, actually?
Well, I think it's simple. You know, we don't easily give children the keys to drive a car. They go through driver's ed or some training. We have to get insurance. We sit and go through our teens' lives by sitting there while they're driving. And then as we get older and become grandparents, we realize that those kids are now better drivers than we are. So they drive when we go places. But, you know, there's this entire evolution of raising them, training them, and then licensing them. And, you know, we sort of keep track early on when they use the car, where they go, how far they've gone, what their curfew is, things like that. You know, you sort of work these boundaries out. Mm-hmm. But when you hand a kid a smartphone today without any of those boundaries, they could be looking at human trafficking, graphic sexual images. I mean, we now know since social media, the age of inception to looking at pornography has dropped by 7 or 8 years. So now we've got 8, 9, 10, 11 year olds, you know, over 60% of the boys looking at pornography more than 2 times a month. And even where there's parents that limit it, they go to somebody's house where they can look at it. So we've got absolutely no parental involvement in managing where kids drive their computers. And so we can't say no. I love social computers are powerful. And in fact, I can go into hypothetical structures of the future where there's a sort of a hive structure of people connected by computers and social media constructs with great boundaries that will able to manage that will be able to manage the world's problems and assets better than anything we can do today. The computers are truly a phenomenal tool. But the fact is that if people, like, you know, guns might be used for good things too, use them for bad things, not a thing, like that hammer. And so we do not spend any time teaching kids how to use these and where to traffic them. And so it's very easy for them to have a lot of, whether it's violence, sexuality, or drugs, huge amounts of reinforcement of these negative activities that break down the minimal amount of time parents engage with kids on these issues.
So what does surviving bad do to educate on that?
Well, basically, have conversations like this. I mean, mm-hmm. I do a lot of forums, and we call them town halls, but they're parent groups. I'll sit in coffee shops and invite parents to come in, you know, I off the grid stuff where they don't usually get a voice, and invite them, whether it's a church group or a school or something like that. You know, you want to get out there and say, listen, we know we have a problem. We know it will solve itself in 20 or 30 years. It does. That's about what it takes in American culture, and maybe quicker with technology. But in the meantime, a lot of bad things are going to happen. So because we're in this time where we haven't managed the risks or taught our children well how to manage these risks, it's exacerbating our ability to be able to give them the right support as humans to make them resilient and to limit the risks that can really hurt them in their lives. And most importantly, I say to empower the good kids to have the knowledge and information to help their friends avoid problems. And so I try to turn it into a positive exercise of investing these messages into kids that are never going to use, so that they can manage their peers better than what we did growing up that allowed these problems to grow.
So I hear you pushing the social norms and the positive message. I don't understand how you have kids affect their peers, except for by themselves setting a positive example. It's not like you're saying, well, we want you to tattletale or, you know, on the kids who are using alcohol and drugs in grade school. It's or are you? Are you just saying that the
no, schools have clubs. Schools have clubs of kids dealing with prevention, with tobacco, with alcohol, with vaping.
Yeah,
that's really growing in Iowa. And they're reaching out to other kids. What they're doing by doing that is making themselves the cool kids.
Yes.
Here, we're getting this. This is really risky. And in many cases, what's fascinating when you dig down into their motivations, it's because all of these old people are trying to get our money. You know, they're looking up at our generation saying they're predators. They don't care about us. They just want us addicted. And that they is not somebody their own age. That they is somebody older. You know, that's they contextualize this in very limited frameworks that I would love to challenge, but I don't need to because they're effective.
Wow.
And so they're bonding together, becoming the cool kids, because if you let them understand that the risk of doing nothing is that their lives are going to be more difficult when they get older. I asked them, I said, would you want to live in a world like you're in today? Would you want to live in a world where all adults that you see on TV and politics are arguing, where we talk about how many people are dying, where nobody can agree on how to take care of anybody? And no, you know, and they say, no. Well, then what are you going to do to change it? And then that they start listening. Because I tell you, if you were a kid and you just were popped into this world,
what do they say when they say, what would you do to change it? What do they say?
Well, they say some very drastic things, but the first thing they usually say is, what can we do? Which is a great question on your part. Yeah. They don't know. And we talk about, well, you can change what politicians are doing and you can get involved in public activities. So we bring kids from middle schools and high schools to the Capitol to talk to their representatives and senators about bills that are important relating to alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. And so we get them engaged in that kind of public service. But one of the things we stress, and they do get it, is that if you're going to study economics, you're going to learn about supply and demand. And if you work within your peer group to lower the demand, 20 years from now, and these companies that are predatory with addictive substances are going to want you as a customer, you won't be there, which means they're going to have to change your business model. They have done that. They've done it by targeting younger and younger children in their advertising.
Yeah,
and I, said, and I thought even Camel cigarettes did that. Budweiser beer did it with frogs and lizards. You know, I mean, they've all tried that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's effective because it works. And, you know, you get kids at a young age, they got a customer for life. So
we teach a digital literacy course. And when we start showing them ads like that, they go, wow, they're trying to get us. they figure it out. So if you teach them that this is what's happening.
That sounds fascinating. Give my audience a little digital literacy lesson.
Well, Dr. Gentile and I, he's a psychologist and a researcher professor at Iowa State University, have worked on a program. And we've done surveys in our school systems here. And what we do is we've even done presentations with magic tricks and stuff in front of school auditoriums and stuff. We show them how the media tricks them into doing things, you know, even showing them the science behind seeing a hamburger on TV and feeling hungry and how mirror neurons work. You know, and I can sit there in front of them and say, listen, I want to show you that I cannot influence your mind. I cannot make you think anything. And at the same time, I flash a picture behind me. I say, for the next 5 minutes, do not think of elephants. And I put up a picture of an elephant.
Now you're going to think about the elephant for all 5 minutes.
All 5 minutes. I mean, I don't have to wait 5 minutes. They're still thinking about it 30 minutes later. I said, so if I say don't smoke, what are you thinking of? That's the criticisms of the people with the no, no, no messages, right? They criticize it. If you say no, 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 they're going to want to do it because that's what they're going to think about. It's going to be in their mind. But if you say, I say that now, what does that tell you? What am I teaching you? What I'm teaching you is you have to understand that between your eyes and the screen, things are happening that you cannot even control because your brain is designed to learn. And the people designing those ads know this, and they know exactly how to influence your behavior. I go, even I, knowing all this science, when I sit down at 9 o'clock at night to finish up my paperwork, get ready to watch the news, and I see a Wendy's commercial or a Burger King commercial, I am so wanting to go out and get a burger. I know this. I mean, it's no different than if I'd want a drink or a cigarette or something else. These messages drive addiction. And I said, there's nothing wrong with watching these things or knowing they're out there. If you know how they influence you, you're going to be less affected by it. Not unaffected, but less affected.
That's great. Peter, you're like, what's that TV show? Is it X-Men? We're like the media marketers of the of the time.
Well, we had psychologists on our staff, but I had an agency long before I was involved in the drug movement. And that's exactly what we were doing is what's the psychology of this ad? How do I go to my client and say why this is going to work on a human being's brain? What are our focus groups?
By the way, it's not just for kids. It's also for doctors because doctors are visited by, pharmaceutical reps. And they'll say, oh, no, no, but I'm not going to be affected. Just because I got a pen from a pharmaceutical rep does not mean I'm going to, prescribe their drug. But yet, if we do studies, we say that that's exactly right. You just went to a dinner and they talked about whatever, Tamiflu all day long. Then the next day you're going to be prescribing Tamiflu. It just kind of happens. And they went all, now we're not allowed to even get pens or anything like that.
Well, the opioid epidemic was a perfect storm of that problem.
Yeah.
Because what they did is they just lied to doctors about the risk factors. And there's many, many doctors that really wish that they had better thought this issue out. But who can read all the research and do a deep dive on every medication you're going to prescribe. You want to trust your sources. So a trustworthy source went out there and committed an illegal act, in my opinion. And based on the lawsuits, I think we all agree on that now.
Well, I was one of those. I followed the herd. Actually, that's how I got into the all business. I got into the whole issue of addiction, correcting a mistake that I made, right? Prescribing opioids willy-nilly, because that is not what my peers did. It's what the government said. I would be sued if I didn't. It really was a whole American movement. You would be ostracized for, you know, I was called not compassionate when I stopped doing that. Right. And, you know, and it took years. It's a lot harder to undo something than it is to do something.
That is great wisdom. It is absolutely a lot harder to undo something. And it's also very, very valuable to learn from other people's mistakes.
Yeah.
Especially the ones close to you. And for children, I think that resonates pretty well too. I said, and you don't need to learn, you know, you can learn from the mistakes of people like me if I'm willing to share them.
Yeah. And I think there's a whole generation who learned off their parents' mistake of smoking, right? It's like, oh, I saw my grandpa. I don't want to, you know, they learned from that negative example.
Oh, my kids, I smoked. My kids came home from school. They drilled me. They made me feel like I was the most evil person in the world. And I promised them I'd quit on my birthday. And it was a little bit after school was out. And I did, because I then faced the fact I promised my children something that I couldn't go against.
The power of kids. So when your kids say, what can you do?
They can do a lot. I tell them about that. I go, you can influence the behavior of your parents a lot. So if your parents are doing bad things, don't look at that as a license for you to do it.
Right.
Try and figure out how you can help them or yourself without making them feel stigmatized. You don't have to go and make them feel bad. You just talk about stuff.
Let's talk about stigma. There's a whole national stigma campaign, and you've mentioned it several times. I've heard people say stigma kills. I don't know if I agree with that. Fentanyl kills. I don't know if the stigma kills. But I think there's a slippery slope with the campaign that we have on stigma, because if you eliminate all stigma, then you're eliminating stigma also to the drug itself. And we don't want people to use drugs.
Exactly.
We
right.
want we want to eliminate, and this is, you know, the fine line. We want to eliminate stigma on the human being, on the compassion. You are a smoker. We're not going to hate dad because he's a smoker. We just love him and we want him to quit. So we have compassion on the human being with the problem. But the product, the tobacco, the marijuana, the alcohol, the Xanaxes, the illicit drugs, that should be stigmatized.
Well, I don't disagree with you, but my most simple response to the idea of stigma is that it has tremendous value, because stigma is a societal adaptation to fear. So if I am about to go into a jungle, I would fear an encounter with a dangerous snake, with a centipede, any number of things. And I have to adapt to that. And I recognize that if I go into that jungle, that the only thing stigma would do would keep me from going there.
I don't know if that's what stigma is. I think stigma is like a moral judgment on something, a negative judgment.
I think it's more
like,
of a,
I
think
snakes.
They shut themselves off.
It's not I'm afraid of snakes in the jungle. It's more like I just hate all snakes. I don't care where they are.
See, I think stigma is almost like what racism used to be years ago. It exists passively, and it works in your way once somebody identifies it exists. But I think it has a lifespan that is simply, how do I walk this world when I encounter something that scares me? I have to put up a little barrier, and I call that barrier stigma.
Well, that's very interesting, and you just taught me something new, Peter, is we don't all agree on the definition of stigma, so it'd be hard to have a campaign, because it means different things to different people.
Well, I know one thing about kids is that they basically try to put stigma into a there's something wrong with the person thing. And to eliminate that is a good thing. And a campaign that works to saying that, you know, if you're avoiding somebody, or if you, you know, look at them as a lesser human being because of something, you might want to take a step back and realize that that's not necessarily the healthiest response. And so I build it in when I talked about peer empowerment and, you know, working with peers. I go, one of the things you have to overcome is your own personal stigma, and the stigma the user has on the non-users. that they don't get where they're coming from, that they don't know who they are, because it's a two-way street, but we don't identify that part of it often.
Yeah. Well, I agree with your definition just there, where it's like you're thinking somebody of a lesser person both ways. But that's not fear. That's more like a judgment.
Well, see, it's a judgment, but what does it turn into if the thing that stigmatizes you gets too close to you?
Avoidance.
It becomes avoidance. And then, you know, if you're avoiding stuff, eventually you start shying away from it and it becomes functioning like fear and anxiety in your life.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. So anxiety, youth anxiety, you tackle and discuss that too. And you do that similar way, right? Youth resiliency, life skills. That's kind of how you started our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we know on all levels of culture at all ages that people are starting to learn that it's like that old adage, if you experience one negative experience, it takes 10 positive experiences to erase the effects on you. We're starting to teach people that as human beings, it is in our very nature to have fear, to be careful, we learn this. So the say no's, the terror stuff, it sort of feeds that aspect of human existence. But as we grow and become more as a species, become more adapted to life on this earth, if we want to sustain, we can take a snapshot of today's stewardship of the earth and say, okay, this is not sustainable. Whether it's climate change, economic, we're not in a sustainable system. So what is the most important asset? And I talk about this in the context of agriculture in Iowa. What's the most important crop we grow? Children. Well, in agricultural science, every year, there isn't a farmer that can predict what's going to happen with that crop. The weather might, who knows what's going to change? The nature of invasive species might change. But they have a great benefit. At the end of that year, they plow it up, harvest, plow up the field, start all over the next year. We can't do that with children. So everything is cumulative. And so our children are a representation of our lives and what we did. And we're the representation of a whole lot of cumulative things that have happened, which as we look at historically, we realize that we maybe have not managed risks well. And part of it, some people say, well, it's because we're in a free society and you should be free to do drugs and alcohol and there should be no laws against anything. I go, well, you can go to total dictatorships. They have the same problem with substance use disorder and everything. I mean, they have the harshest penalties in some Asian countries where they'll cut your head off if you have meth. Yeah. And yet they have a huge problem with meth users. That kind of stuff, that kind of scare it straight doesn't seem to work. So to develop a compassionate culture, we have to be willing to say we're going to innovate. And if you're going to innovate, this is where we get away from evidence-based. If you're in a business and you're doing status quo, I sell hot dogs or hamburgers, I want to make the best hamburgers and the best hot dogs. And if I can stay with this formula, I will be successful, make a lot of money, and I can franchise, I can do whatever I want to do. But human life and a limited resource like a planet Earth doesn't respect those same boundaries. So we count on innovations. And so we've had this wonderful innovation of technology, which I think is going to be the key to curing and solving these problems if it's used the right way in the future. But those innovations did not come from people that followed the status quo, even the warnings of the status quo. They were people willing to think outside of those constructs. But the interesting thing about innovators is that they were usually pretty adept at living in a well-constructed world. An innovator was not necessarily a rebel. You know, they say Einstein was bad at math in school. Yes, he was, but he went to school and he got his report card and he did not drop out. And he didn't, he went through that, but he innovated a new way of thinking about math that made sense to him. Because absolutely the math he was taught didn't make sense.
Right. I like that. When we're talking about evidence-based and innovation, especially when it comes to primary prevention and the future of our youth, Song for Charlie, I don't know if you've heard of them. They says he adopted the campaign of just say no, KNOW, which goes to everything like that. You say that, right? So just say no, being able to understand. Now, what about deterrence? You know, we want positive reinforcements, avoiding, you know, I remember that and definitely did that with my own kids. You say the word no, you save it. You're not allowed to say no, but you save it for when you really, really need it. Otherwise, it's like, you know, instead of, And I teach this also with patients. Instead of saying, you know, can I have more drugs? The answer is not no. It'd be more like, well, tell me how you're feeling. Let's figure out what's best for you. It's like, you know, can I have a cookie? The answer is not no. It's more like, well, why don't you eat your dinner first, and then, you know, we can have one. Or, but sometimes you need to say no, and sometimes there needs to be consequences or deterrence for bad behavior. And I see that being avoided on kids to their detriment. So, you know, kids are dealing drugs and they'll say, well, they're a minor, you know, they don't deserve to be penalized. They get a pass and they know that. But what happens is then they turn 18 and they continue that bad behavior, and now life's not going so well for them. If they had that deterrence when they were young, they could have changed their life and around and had a better future. What's the role of deterrence?
Boy, that's a multifaceted one, because some is public safety. You know, that still goes back to the, do we do demand reduction or supply reduction?
And or
the
both.
Right answer is both. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
You know, we have generational problems that really take a community, church members, neighbors, and you can't reach everybody. We have socioeconomic issues with income disparity and, you know, lack of food, other resources, food deserts. We have huge mechanisms working in our communities. It's like, you know, you go to a food desert in a poor community, but you find tons of places to buy marijuana and beer and alcohol and tobacco, but not a ton of places to buy food.
That's so kind of my thought also, where we say, well, don't use fentanyl, but we have, like, you know, marijuana and drugs and all these other things around.
That was going to be my next point. As we normalize anything that all, you know, my feeling is that we had a wonderful system that we should have really empowered legally, and that's the FDA. FDA-approved medicines distributed by pharmacies, prescribed by doctors. As soon as you take one, and that's what marijuana did. The rest of it was illegal, but they figured out a way to end run it, and they did it. And our kids are being heavily influenced by that. And so it's very hard for, you know, why did you take that pill? Oh, come on, you know, we can smoke marijuana. Why can't do a pill? We actually know this. If you're in medicine, if you're in prevention or treatment, you absolutely know that, forget gateway. These are all gateways to more excessive risk-taking with substances, whether it starts with alcohol or nicotine or marijuana. And now this proliferation of marijuana, I think, is going to be the next epidemic of substance use disorder, and bigger than anyone we've ever seen in this country, because the average age of first use of marijuana is so young compared to opioids. The power of influencing a young brain in a negative way and permanently changing the way it works to put that child at risk as an adult is phenomenal. So we have not stood up from the public safety side or federal or state governments supporting the FDA. I mean, our doctors need to have the help of the FDA and everything done in pharmacology, and so that
it's so true. First of all, I think it's already happening with marijuana at a young age and affecting a generation. The reason is we're not measuring it, we're not codifying it. I think it's already here, and it may take some more years for us to document it, but I think it's already happening. And you're right about the medical profession. I actually fear for our profession, because if you get rid of FDA and everybody's kind of like their own doctor, you know, I'm going to take my own Xanax, my own marijuana. I got some psychedelics because I'm a little anxious and it helps me. Then what's the point of going to med school? You know, you don't need any doctors or hospitals. You could just treat yourself.
It is definitely problematic. And I'm disappointed that we've done this, because we're laying a problem on future generations that they're not aware of the consequences of yet. And they're not unintended. We know what they are. And even the purveyors of these products know the risks, but they make money off of addiction.
Right. Addiction for profit.
The most profitable things in this culture are the most addictive.
Peter, this is such an exciting conversation. I feel like I could talk for you for hours more, and maybe we will at some point. Final thoughts for our audience, hopes for the future.
Well, I think one thing that we need to do is really connect with our kids and listen to them. I think we need to share the risks. We need to empower our educators and ourselves to take some influence in their lives. And in many respects, if that contact point is social media, talk to them about it. You know, I'm not going to tell you to go tell a kid absolutely no unless you're willing to go in there and talk to them about why you say the no. And the important thing to know is, too, is you don't have to be a doctor or a scientist or a prevention person. As a parent or a grandparent, we know that kids don't want to disappoint you. So if you give them a good a no and say, listen, I just know this is bad and I don't want you to do it, and maybe I don't know enough, but you can research it if you want to. You know, just let them know that you care, and that if you got to be very specific, I think smoking or vaping or whatever you're dealing with is bad, and I would be really disappointed if you did that. I mean, build that connection, and that opens a corridor for conversation. And you can do that with a loved one, you can do that with a sibling, and you can do it with friends. But starting with children, I think, is really important. And in spite of your own failings, if you look in the mirror and say, but I drank when I was young, how can I tell my child not to? Well, the world is different today. The risks are greater. And it's that very experience you have that should warn you that there are risks here, because we've all grown up with people that didn't do it responsibly. And we don't want our kids to be on that path.
The power of your conviction and your message to the people that you love, you know, not to underestimate that. I love that. I want to say thank you so much for RG, our medical student, who's going to be a great emergency physician one day. You're going to have a wonderful career and life, starting out with such great questions such as prevention to what you're seeing around you. So I wish you the best of luck, and thank you to you, Peter Komendowski.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for joining the show.
It's been a pleasure, and like I said, this is a conversation that we could have for days, but parents and children and everybody else should have for days.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaac1.org. That's ISIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.